have other countries around the world. You have China, Russia, Iran, India. We have these emerging countries that represent regional threats, only because these countries now have the ability to chart their own paths of independent development, and that is very concerning to the United States and its goals of, you know, world hegemony.
The United States has existed for 246 years and been at war for 228 of them. They have nearly 800 military bases stationed in over 40% of the world's nations. Washington's war machine is strong, but activists say the average American's desire for peace is far stronger. Ramin Mazahari, Chicago.
A British public school in London has sparked controversy amid furious parent complaints that their children are being prevented from performing obligatory Islamic prayers during school hours. Michaela Community School in Wembley have been accused of blatant Islamophobia after students allegedly informed parents of several incidents which saw teachers interrupting praying pupils in an apparent attempt to ban Muslim worship. News first broke of the scandal after a petition was launched demanding that the school provide a prayer space for students. The petition lists examples of what allegedly took place.
On Thursday, the 23rd of March, students at Michaela were performing their obligatory prayers at the schoolyard. The pupils were praying on their prayer mats, and the teacher approaches the students and tells them to stop praying. She then says, "You need to leave your Islamic cultures alone. This is the West." She then tells them that they're not allowed a prayer mat at this school, and she says if she sees this again, she will give them a detention. One of the students praying was then excluded.
The story is concerning enough on its own, but what makes matters worse is that it's far from the only example of a UK school apparently showing signs that it may have a problem with its religious Muslim students. Over the past 24 months, multiple other examples have popped up across the country with schools facing similar accusations.
In December 2021, Manchester's Oldham Academy School apologised after students felt forced to pray outside in the cold. In January 2022, Park High School in Stanmore went viral over footage allegedly showing a teacher attempting to halt Juma prayers. While this year has also seen two Birmingham-based schools embroiled in a row over LGBT propaganda lessons, seemingly targeting Muslim students in an attempt to change their understanding of Islam's position on same-gender relationships.
Don't remain silent, don't suffer in silence. So in specific cases like these, school kids need to record these incidents and write down witness statements ASAP and then get parents and police involved, because when the shoe is on the other foot and a Muslim child is accused of extremism, police are called in against you. Equality cuts both ways. And the bigger picture, it needs to involve a sustained effort by the Muslim community to abnormalize Islamophobia in media and politics. So irrelevant politicians and journalists who have nothing useful to say to society stop benefiting from dividing us.
Michaela Community School has so far not responded to the story, but with so many similar incidents of alleged Islamophobia occurring in UK schools, the toxic atmosphere is likely part of a much bigger problem. Robert Carter, London.
A new report by the UNHCR has revealed that women's businesses in Afghanistan are severely affected by the Taliban's increasing restrictions. The report shows a sharp decline of women's participation in the labor market from 28% to 7%, and the consequent impact on the Afghan economy, that is witnessing a 30 to 35% drop in GDP in the past 2 years.
We Afghan women can help Afghanistan economy and people's livelihood grow. Afghanistan is a rich country, especially when it comes to agricultural, minerals and handicraft. Afghan women can play a vital role in developing these sectors and contributing to national incomes. However, they need more opportunities and support to lead their business and pursue their passions. This means they need work license, freedom of movement and access to local and global market.
Here in the women's market in Kabul, we spoke with some business women who told us their stories of hardship and resilience amid the Taliban's limitations. They say they're losing customers and opportunities which are meant to develop their businesses. some of them have experienced a significant drop in their income, while others fear they may have to shut down their businesses soon.
Unfortunately, the Taliban's restrictions on women have wiped out educational and business opportunities. Women can't work in such a limited environment. Here in the women's market, we are receiving fewer customers, contractors, and funds than ever before. My fellow entrepreneurs are desperate, with some aiming to close their shops and end activities.
Many NGOs have stopped working with business women after the Taliban banned NGOs' female workers. These NGOs used to help us with getting work permits, finding contractors, and supplying some essentials. But all these supports are gone. As a result, we are operating at a loss since we have to pay for farmers' wages and production costs without any income.
Emphasizing the need for women's economic empowerment, UNHCR has called on the Taliban to respect and safeguard the rights to work and education for women. The agency has also appealed to the international community to sustain its support for humanitarian and development initiatives that benefit women and girls in Afghanistan. The plight of Afghan business women is just one example of how Afghan women are impacted by the Taliban restrictions. Now, it's a matter of time that whether the de facto authorities will change their policies against women. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
The strike group of the USS Nimitz aircraft carrier conducted military exercises off the Korean Peninsula this week. This follows 11 days of the largest land-based drills involving South Korea and the U.S. in almost 5 years. The U.S. has increased joint drills with South Korea in the past year, particularly those involving nuclear-capable weapons, so-called strategic assets.
The United States has deployable strategic assets at the ready on every day. And we can continue to deploy those assets, and we will. Again, we really want to underpin the international security and the global commons so we can all prosper. And I think that's our message.
North Korea protested the drills test-firing ballistic and cruise missiles as Pyongyang views such exercises as a rehearsal for invasion. The Nimitz drills were followed up with a massive joint U.S.-South Korea amphibious landing exercise Wednesday. Activists argue such drills carry risks.
The more South Korea-U.S. military exercises are conducted, the larger the scale, the stronger the North is protesting and testing more missiles. If the South Korea-U.S. military exercises expand, the confrontation will intensify, and I think increase this vicious cycle of confrontation.
For President Yoon Suk-yeol, the drills show how he's succeeded in strengthening the U.S.-South Korea alliance. South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol earlier this month re-emphasized his hardline position with North Korea, saying that Pyongyang would pay a price for its recent missile launches, what he calls provocations. President Yoon also said North Korea would not receive a penny in aid from the South as long as it continued its nuclear weapons development. The confrontation on the Korean Peninsula may heat up further with even larger exercises planned to celebrate the 70th anniversary of the U.S.-South Korea alliance in June. Frank Smith, Seoul.
A massive march has been held along the fence separating the Gaza Strip from the occupied territories to commemorate the 47th anniversary of the Land Day. People from all walks of life took to the streets of the besieged Gaza Strip to stress their right to return to their land.
We are here today to commemorate the Land Day to stress on our Palestinian identity and our entitlement to the land. We say to the Israeli occupation, you have no place in Palestine. Leave it so the world can eventually enjoy peace and freedom.
Land Day marks the events of March the 30th, 1976, where six Palestinians were killed by Israeli forces during peaceful protests against the Tel Aviv regime's decision to seize tracts of Palestinian-owned lands. Palestinians call on the international community and the Arab countries to support the Palestinian people in their quest for liberation.
We are addressing all the international community, the Arabs, the Muslims in the world, to stand up, to stand up with us, to support also our resistance to return to my home. We are refugees. We are going to return sooner or later.
The National and Islamic Action factions emphasized the unity of the Palestinian people. They also reaffirmed the Palestinians' right to resist, stressing that resistance is the sole way to restore the stolen Palestinian land.
Today we assert on the Palestinians' adherence to their lands and to the Al-Quds, the eternal capital of Palestine, and we affirm on the resistance as the most appropriate choice to free Palestine.
The Thursday peaceful demonstration turned violent when the Israeli forces shot and injured a Palestinian with live ammunition. Two others were injured when they were hit by tear gas canisters used by the regime's troops to disperse the protesters. This reminds us of what happened in the Great March of Return rallies, which began in 2018 and lasted for 86 weeks. During the protests, more than 300 Palestinians were killed by the Israeli troops, and thousands more sustained injuries, including so serious wounds that led to the loss of limbs.
I was wounded with Israeli live ammunition in the Great March of Return, and today, despite my injury in my leg that might get amputated, I am here today to commemorate the Land Day, stress on our steadfastness despite the Israeli atrocities.
The Israeli regime seizes the Palestinian own land and demolishes Palestinians' homes in the occupied West Bank and Al-Quds in order to construct new illegal settlements.
These annual demonstrations serve as an act of collective resistance to the Israeli occupation, as Palestinian demonstrators voice their anger at the regime's crimes and land grab policies and reiterate their entitlement and right of return to their own land, Al-Asif, Gaza.
Picnic, but no picnic. This year, Iranians celebrated Seize Badr with a twist. As the holy month of Ramadan started on the third day of the Persian New Year, Iranians who are now also fasting have had to modify some Nowruz traditions, including the annual family picnic on the 13th day of the New Year, called Seize Badr, or Nature Day, an occasion which marks the end of the New Year holidays and usually falls on April the 2nd.
Normally, we would be spending time outdoors early in the morning and prepare lunch, but this year we left home just a couple of hours before sunset.
It's Ramadan and we are fasting, so we took our iftar meal to break our fast here in the park.
And while some have brought their iftar with them, others have decided to prepare it as they wait for sunset to break their fast.
I got some fresh bread, and I also invited my aunt to come here so we can have iftar together.
We are going to have our usual iftar, nothing special, just bread and cheese with walnuts.
In the capital, Tehran, the municipality has decided to make this Seize Badr a memorable one with entertaining activities.
We have a special entertaining activities and games for all age groups. Everything here is free of charge. Music bands also play Iranian folk music to make the day more memorable. We also have a special Quranic activities. It's both fun and games.
The Holy Quran was revealed to Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, during the holy month of Ramadan, so Nowruz this year was twice a cause for celebration, spring and the rebirth of nature and our spiritual rebirth as we spend time fasting, praying and reciting the Holy Quran. I've been teaching the Holy Quran to children for over 19 years, and I can tell you that it is a great blessing. Celebrating Nature Day and Ramadan together makes today even more special. Tehran municipality has arranged to distribute free iftar meals in 8 of the largest parks in the capital. We have also set up a few stations where people can buy handicraft from other regions of Iran. We have tried our best to make this an opportunity for people to enjoy their time.
And this is how Iranians have wrapped up 2 weeks of Nowruz holidays, a very special Nowruz that coincided with the holy month of Ramadan. Hizumi Shahmadi, Tehran.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio. With you every single moment.
Supplication on Wednesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah who appointed the night to be a garment, and sleep for a rest, and day he appointed for a rising. To thee belongs praise, for thou roused me from my sleep. And hadst thou willed, thou wouldst have made it everlasting, an everlasting praise that will never be cut off, and whose number the creatures will never count. O Allah, to thee belongs praise, for thou created, then proportioned, and ordained and decreed, and gave death and bestowed life, and made sick and healed, and made well and afflicted, and sat upon the throne and encompassed the kingdom. I supplicate thee with the supplication of one whose mediation is weak, whose stratagems have been cut off, whose term has drawn near, whose expectation from this world has shrunk, whose neediness for thy mercy has intensified, whose remorse for his neglect has become great, whose slips and stumbles have become many, and whose repentance is devoted sincerely to thy face. So bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and his household, the good, the pure, and provide me with the intercessions of Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, and deprive me not of his companionship. Surely thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, decree for me on Wednesday 4 things. Induce me to be strong in obedience to thee, to be joyful in worshipping thee, to be desirous of thy reward, and to abstain from that which would make incumbent upon me thy painful punishment. Thou art gentle to whom thou wilt.
Miss Mutley.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashemi. Thanks so much for being with us. More Palestinian families are mourning after Israeli occupation forces invaded Nablus early on Monday, killing two more young men, while the murder of Mohammed Nasser Saeed and Mohammed Abu Bakr Janaidi brings the number of Palestinians killed so far this year to 95. Today marks the 93rd day of the year, meaning on average one Palestinian has been killed every day in the occupied territories by Israeli troops this year. And Tel Aviv's crimes may only get worse as the Israeli government has given the green light to establish a National Guard whose focus is supposed to be what is being called Arab unrest. Stay with us as we take a look at the occupied territories on the Spotlight. I'd like to welcome my guests to this program. Mohsen Naqvi, human rights activist out of Houston, Texas. Mohammed Abu Saad, professor of political science, Al-Azhar, University of Gaza City.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Thank you both for being with me on the program. I'd like to start this off in Houston. And Mohsen, it appears that there is a new level of desperation and fear on the side of the Israeli regime as it continues to become more aggressive against Palestinians. Your thoughts on this?
Yes, and their aggression in the past few months has been focused more towards Jenin and Nablus. And that's primarily because of the strengthening of the resistance movements in these two areas. Nablus and Jenin, the Lion's Den in Nablus and the Jenin Brigade in Jenin have been retaliating to Israeli atrocities in the past few months, which, as per international law, is their fundamental right. Now, it is because of this resistance that Israel, or the Zionist regime, believes and thinks that by raiding these areas or by arresting members of the Lion's Den and the Jenin Brigade, this resistance will be stopped. But they are incorrect. The resistance strengthens with every arrest that the Zionist regime makes, and with every resistance fighter that the Zionist regime illegally kills and murders, more resistance fighters are added to the list of members in the Lion's Den and the Jenin Brigade. And the reason for that is primarily because both of these resistance forces now have popular support in these two areas. And the reason, this is how we can analyze as to why these resistance movements have become so popular, is because whenever a resistance fighter is martyred in either Nablus or Jenin, you see masses over masses in these funerals. And that is an indication to the popularity of these movements. It is not as if these are a bunch of youngsters, teenagers, or young adults who are emotional and they're fighting. No, they have the support of majority on that.
Okay. Well, Muhammad, is all of this simply the modus operandi of the regime's forces, trying to keep the Palestinian population under pressure and trying to instill fear in them as Israeli soldiers have raided Palestinian areas on an almost daily basis this year?
Many thanks for inviting me to be part of this program, Spotlight. Well, let me start by saying that the Israeli regime has systematically inflicted killing and massacres against the Palestinian people over the past 75 years. Even before the establishment of the State of Israel on May 15 of 1948, the Israeli terrorist groups like the Haganah, Ashtarin, and other Zionist terrorist groups inflicted massacres against the Palestinians in Deir Yassin and later on in Kfar Qasim. And you can very much count more than 50 Israeli massacres against the Palestinian people since 1948. So Israel has systematically inflicted killing, massacres, bloodshed against the Palestinian people. It seems to me that Israel, and I agree with you, that Israel is trying so to speak, to deter the Palestinians from resisting the Israeli occupation and to make a note on that right at the start of the Palestinian Second Intifada in the year of 2000, the Israeli Minister of Army, Moshe Ya'alon, at that time, said that the aim of Israel is to make the Palestinian think many times before they engage into resisting the Israeli occupation. And over the past many years, thousands of Palestinians have been killed, executed, their homes have been confiscated, and to name many, many other Israeli practices and policies against the Palestinians. But at the end of the day, this Israeli policy has failed to deter the Palestinians from resisting the Israeli occupation. The Palestinians very much believe and they are convinced that they have the right legally to resist the Israeli occupation. It's their right to put an end to this occupation that has been going on for at least 55 years now since the occupation of West Bank, Gaza, and East Jerusalem in 1967. And the Palestinians believe that justice is on their side, and international law also is on their side. Okay. No matter what policies are used by Israel to deter them or to scare them from resisting this ugly and appalling occupation, that won't succeed with the Palestinians. And let me just make one final note on this. Mm-hmm. On this, the Israeli journalist Gideon Levy, in one of his OPED pieces about a year ago, he said that Israel has done almost everything possible to kill the Palestinians, eradicate them, finish them, liquidate their cause. But the Palestinians, as he argued in his piece, that they are made of a different composition, so to speak, that the Palestinians, nothing has succeeded with deterring the Palestinians. And that is... as an eyewitness, an Israeli journalist, Gideon Levy, who said that in one of his pieces.
Okay. Thank you, Mohammed. Well, Mohsen, you heard what our guest in Gaza City said, and he touched on international law. I want to look at that aspect a little bit, because under the Fourth Geneva Convention, Israel is in violation of so many of these rules, from the illegal occupation itself to its illegal settlements, and confiscating the land of those occupied areas, or arresting without trial, or enacting collective punishment, so many other things that are being done, all against international law. So what does these international rules mean if they're not followed, or the entity not following them goes unpunished? Okay. Mohsen, I'm going to get back to you because I can't hear you. Either it's from your side or from my side in the studio. Well, try again, Mohsen. Let me hear you again. Let me see if it's working.
Is it working
yes.
now?
Yes, it is. Go ahead.
So, yeah, I was saying that the international courts of justices have failed as an international organization. But the fact that they do have a set of rules, and the expectation is for all member states or all states of the world to comply by those rules and regulations, Israel has made it quite clear, and so has the U.S. empire. They've made it quite clear that they don't respect international law. As long as international law doesn't favor them, they don't respect it. And more than anything, more than statements, we can see with the actions of the Zionist regime, with the occupations that they've made, even though that they've signed contracts like the Oslo Accords, they don't respect any treaty or any agreement that they make. They have had a history of lies, and the Palestinians have had it enough. These international laws are used and abused to only favor the Western regimes, regimes like the U.S. empire. It has failed to provide any form of justice to any country in the world. I mean, we saw in the Syrian, in the earthquakes in Syria, even though the U.S. had sanctioned all aid that was to be provided to the Syrian to Syria, the International Court of Justice failed to intervene or give any kind of indication that the U.S. should alter their laws. Obviously, it was international pressure because of which they changed or altered those sanctions. But the international courts, in essence, have failed. All resistance movements, whether Israel or the U.S. empire likes it or not, are within international law to defend themselves, especially if they are being occupied and being murdered and slaughtered. This is the least that they can do. If anything, international, the great power, the so-called great powers of the world, should support the resistance movements on the ground in Palestine.
Well, Mohammed, we see the Israeli regime increasing in its brutality, whether we're talking about how it attacks Palestinians so aggressively or how it bombs and kills in Syria. Is this due to desperation or impunity? How do you see it?
Well, it's both. One thing is that Israel has succeeded in escaping any sanctions from the international community. From the day of its establishment, as I just mentioned earlier, so many crimes, so many massacres, and violations of international law that have been taken by the Israeli armed forces. And unfortunately, the international community, whether it's the UN or Western countries, have failed miserably to put an end to this Israeli aggression, whether it's against the Palestinians, or the Lebanese, or the Syrians, or the Arabs and the region in general. But let me also add one more point. I think the think of the Israeli military and security establishment, they think that by committing those crimes against the Palestinians and the Arabs, they think that the Israeli way of deterrence that will deter the Palestinians and the Arabs from attacking Israel. It's what is called deterrence in the thinking of the military establishment and security establishment in Israel. So it's both. It's both that the impunity of Israel from any international accountability in which we haven't seen any international actions, whether it's sanctions or punishment or even isolating this Israeli regime, to even investigate these Israeli crimes. Let me just give you a very quick example of what we are witnessing right now. In less than a year, the international community, the ICC, the International Criminal Court, have gone on to investigating the so-called Russian war crimes in Ukraine in less than a year, and there is already an arrest warrant against the Russian President Vladimir Putin because of accusations of war crimes in Ukraine. The Palestinians have been subjected to war crimes for more than 55 years, and there are requests by the Palestinians, Palestinian human rights groups, and the Palestinian state at the ICC. But unfortunately, the ICC, as Mohsen has indicated, has failed so far to even investigate in a very serious way these Israeli crimes against the Palestinians. And let me be honest with you. What we hear from Western diplomats and international diplomats, that unfortunately they are very sensitive to the so-called security of Israel and to the security of Jews because of what happened to the Jews during World War II or the so-called Holocaust. So it seems to me that the international community is afraid to even deal or to even touch those Israeli crimes against the Palestinians because of the so-called the Holocaust and what was what happened to the Jews during World War II.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Well, interesting points that you made, Muhammad. And most of actually the South African foreign minister, Dr. Nadelde Pandor, has recently asked the question, what is the difference between Ukraine being occupied and how the so-called international community reacted and Palestine being occupied? She said, if there are international rules, then their rules should apply equally to all. Your take on that? And it also seems like there is a growing awareness across the board internationally of the rights of the Palestinians and speaking up for the Palestinians. Your thoughts?
Yes. So globally, there's no doubt that the U.S. empire and the allies of the U.S. empire have had a history of picking and choosing who they want to support. Their policies, their foreign policies, are not based on morality, ethics, or justice. Their policies are based on self-interest, and that even if that self-interest may incur harm on an innocent people, we've seen the role that the U.S. empire and its allies played in Iraq, in Afghanistan. So what's happening in Ukraine right now, the Ukraine-Russian conflict, it shouldn't have anything to do with the U.S. empire. But as Imam Khamenei has stated, that it is in the self-interest of the U.S. empire that this conflict remains. It is not in their interest. A solution to the Ukraine conflict is not in the interest of the U.S. empire because of organizations like, because of the weapons industry. It benefits them in every way. Now, to your second point, international law has failed to provide justice to the Palestinians. It has failed to provide justice to the Venezuelans. It has failed to provide justice to Iraqis, to Afghanis, all over the world. So when reliance upon international law decreases, or when reliance upon the so-called world power decreases in the form of sanctions, these countries, they become self-reliant upon their own resources and upon their own technologies. And we see Iran as a prime example of becoming self-reliant. We see Iran working on themselves and developing their own drones, developing their own satellite systems. And so Iran has become that prime example for all oppressed nations of the world that the solution is not reliance on the West. The solution is to become self-reliant on your own resources and your own expertise.
Okay. Well, Mohammed, there's continuous aggression on the part of the Israeli regime forces, of course, against the Palestinians. Now that a National Guard has been approved, which will, it says, allegedly deal with Arabs. Your overall perspective about this, do you see the situation deteriorating for Palestinians?
It seems to me, yes. The answer, the quick answer to your question is yes. What Israel has done over the past 75 years against the Palestinians seems to Itamar Ben-Gvir and the fascist right wing in Israel is not enough. And that's why they are establishing a so-called National Guard force to deal with the Palestinians purposefully. What has happened over the past few days is a deal has been struck between Prime Minister Netanyahu and the Minister of National Security, Itamar Ben-Gvir, to establish a National Guard force to deal specifically with the Palestinians. And as the leader of the Israeli opposition, Yair Lapid, has indicated yesterday that the Israeli government has decided to cut some of the money that goes to the ministries of education, health, social affairs, and other ministries, and to try to invest in this new force, the National Guard. And Itamar Ben-Gvir, the Minister of National Security in Israel, was crystal clear on that. He said this: the aim or the goal of this force is to deal with the Palestinians. And he gave an example of what happened 2 years ago when Israel launched a war against the Palestinians in Gaza in May of 2021. And the Palestinians inside Israel, where there are 2 million Palestinians live inside Israel, rose up against the Israeli occupation against and also against Israeli discrimination in the cities of Lod, Yaffa, and Galilee. All of these areas, the Palestinians started to protest against the Israeli apartheid regime because of discrimination. And Itamar Ben-Gvir believed that the Israeli army and the Israeli police did not deal in a very forceful way against the Palestinians. And that's why he has decided to establish or to form this National Guard force to deal with the Palestinians, mainly in the Beersheba area and also in the Galilee area, and also to deal with the Palestinians. It's a National Guard force that will include some of the most extreme and right-wing Israelis. And so to speak, these some of them are expected of inflicting some terrorist acts against the Palestinians, like the fire that was set up in Hawara just about a month ago. Mm-hmm. So this force will include some of the right-wing settlers who also live in the West Bank to scare off the Palestinians from resisting the Israeli occupation.
Sorry to interrupt you because we're running out of time. But doesn't that prove in itself that they have to create this National Guard that they are losing, that they are not on top of it? Otherwise, why would they have to create another entity? Mohsen, your take on that?
Yeah, as I mentioned before as well, this is a show of desperation on part of the Zionist regime. They were of the mindset that a right-wing extremist like Ben-Gvir would come into power and changes would be made, that they would be able to succumb the Palestinian resistance into giving up their arms. And they used the PLO. They tried to bribe resistance fighters from the Lion's Den. They tried to bribe resistance fighters from the Jenin Brigade, and they absolutely failed. Meaning, they may have PLO as their stooges on ground, arresting and detaining illegally arresting and detaining members of the Jenin Brigade and the Lion's Den. But they have failed. The creation of this National Guard force, the only thing that it will do is that it will make the resistance stronger and Israel weaker.
Stay with me, Mohsen. Mohammed, last question. Are you more optimistic today about the future of the Palestinians because of the amount of resistance, or your overall assessment?
Look, over the past one century, the Palestinians have faced so many Israeli policies of aggression, killing, land confiscation, and you name it. And all of these Israeli policies have not put an end to the Palestinian goal of ending this Israeli occupation and establishing a Palestinian independent state. And it seems to me that what we are witnessing from the internal crisis inside Israel between the right-wing or the extreme right-wing and fascist forces and the so-called secular and liberal forces inside Israel, it seems to me that the Israeli liberal and secular forces have come to the conclusion that this right-wing fascist Israelis are not a danger against the Palestinians. They are also a danger to the so-called liberals and seculars inside Israel. It seems to me that justice is on the side of the Palestinians. International law is on the side of the Palestinians. And no matter what Israel has is going to do to try to scare off and deter the Palestinians from resisting this Israeli occupation, the Palestinians have proven that they will continue their fight for
and
freedom, justice,
and independence.
And I hate to
interrupt you, but I am really out of time. I appreciate both of you being with me. Mohsen Naqvi, human rights activist out of Houston, Texas. Mohammed Abu Saeed, a professor of political science out of Gaza City. And as always, we appreciate you being with us on another Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi.
From east to west, throughout the vast land of Iran, you're listening to IRIB English Radio. In the limelight.
Since the start of the conflict between Russia and Ukraine, the United States and its European allies have imposed an array of unprecedented sanctions against Russia and poured numerous advanced weaponry into Ukraine, despite repeated warnings by Kremlin that such measures will only prolong the war. Russian officials have also charged the United States of being prepared to sacrifice Ukraine and the developing world in order to beat Russia and maintain its global hegemony. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this issue. Please stay with us. Website of Fact Checked has covered this story and tells us more. According to a report, the United States has sent more military assistance to help Ukraine fight Russia than Washington spent annually to fight its own war in Afghanistan. The data compiled by the German research firm Statista showed that the U.S. military aid to Ukraine up to mid-January, covering the first 11 months of the conflict, totaled $46.6 billion. Citing data from the Kiel Institute for the World Economy, Statista said, that compared with an average annual military spending of $43.4 billion during the first 10 years of the war in Afghanistan. Statista data journalist Martin Armstrong said, when calculating the average annual costs of previous wars in which the United States has been involved in, the true magnitude of the country's Ukraine aid expenditure can be seen. Martin Armstrong added, the Ukraine total doesn't include an additional $5 billion worth of weapons and equipment that the Pentagon sent to Kiev. The figures, however, exclude non-military aid, such as the $4.5 billion that U.S. President Joe Biden pledged to fund pensions, government salary, and another public spending. In total, the United States has allocated $113 billion in Ukraine aid, and multiple administration officials have vowed to keep supporting Kiev as long as it takes. Americans have sent more money to Ukraine than Russia spends on its annual military budget. Russia spends about $65 to $70 billion a year. The U.S. sent more than $100 billion, including non-military aid, and plus there are the other NATO countries and those in Asia who also support Ukraine. A number of U.S. lawmakers, such as Representatives Seth Moulton of Massachusetts and Marjorie Taylor Greene of Georgia, have called the Ukraine conflict a proxy war that the United States and NATO are waging against Russia. Marjorie Taylor Greene called the war in Ukraine a deadly, profitable industry and demanded the U.S. withdrawal from NATO military alliance. While referring to the Biden administration's massive military aid to Ukraine as a proxy war against Russia that Americans have no appetite for, Marjorie Taylor Greene said, "The American people do not want war with Russia, but NATO and our own foolish leaders are dragging us into one. We should pull out of NATO." In a series of tweets in which she has expressed fierce criticism of Washington's response to the Ukraine conflict by sending billions of taxpayer dollars to the country and risking a potential nuclear war, Marjorie Taylor Greene further added that Ukraine is now the new Iraq, wrapped up with a pretty little NATO bow with a nuclear present inside. CNN has also covered this story and tells us more. A senior U.S. official has said the United States is preparing a fresh military aid package to Ukraine worth $2 billion, defying repeated warnings from Moscow as the war completes 1 year. U.S. President Joe Biden's National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan made the disclosure recently, asserting that Washington is ready to support Kiev for the long haul. While announcing new aid, Jake Sullivan said, "We're going to continue to look at what is necessary and make sure that we provide what is necessary, that Ukraine has what it needs to succeed on the battlefield." U.S. National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan, who accompanied Joe Biden on an unannounced trip to Kiev recently, said U.S. officials are constantly looking to give Volodymyr Zelensky's administration the tools that it needs to win against Russia. He did not reveal details of the new military aid package, but Western media reports said it builds on previous packages of aid to Kiev. CNN reports said the $2 billion package includes new funding for contracts including HIMARS rockets, 155mm artillery munition, drones, counter-drone equipment, mine-clearing equipment, and secure communications equipment. Jake Sullivan said the U.S. has provided Kiev with assistance it needs for each phase of the war, but acknowledged that the Ukrainians have often asked for more than the United States is willing to give them. The top U.S. security official, National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan, reiterated the Biden administration's position that it's not currently providing F-16 fighter jets to Ukraine, much to the chagrin of Ukrainian officials. Meanwhile, Germany's Chancellor Olaf Scholz said whether or not to arm Ukraine with drones doesn't make any sense at the moment. Olaf Scholz, who has previously faced criticism for pulling back on sending tanks to Ukraine, said difficulties faced by other countries in meeting Ukraine's military demands vindicated his decision to move to lock them down. Earlier this month, Germany agreed to send heavy battle tanks to help Ukraine attack Russian forces in the east of the country, allowing other countries to send them. However, the delivery has so far been slow due to limited donor resources. Russia Today, the RT network, has also covered this story and tells us more. A former U.S. state senator says the United States is to blame for constantly meddling in the internal affairs of independent countries and starting both wars in Iraq and Ukraine. Former state senator from Virginia, Richard Black, said the U.S. overthrew the governments of both of these countries to turn them into puppets, stressing that Washington is the source of both the Iraq and the Ukraine conflicts. Richard Black also pointed out that while most Americans do not want to be involved in the conflicts, the U.S. foreign policy establishment pursues its own separate agenda. Richard Black insisted that the U.S. overthrew Iraq with military force coming in from across the globe and has gone in and overthrown Ukraine with military force from the other side of the globe. The former state senator said the Ukraine conflict broke out when the CIA staged a violent, bloody coup d'etat in Kiev in 2014 and helped remove the legitimately elected president of Ukraine, Viktor Yanukovych, from power. Richard Black added, Washington replaced Viktor Yanukovych with a so-called revolutionary junta and began flooding Kiev with advanced weaponry with the aim of building up a very formidable military force. Richard Black clarified Ukraine's current president is nothing more than a puppet of Washington, who does what he's told and when he's told. According to the former senator, while most of the American population does not agree with the U.S. interventionist foreign policies, a group of so-called Washington elites, as well as oligarchs and the weapons manufacturing military-industrial complex, pursue their own interests, irrespective of others. Former Senator Richard Black further stated the conflict in Ukraine could be resolved if the country becomes neutral and demilitarized, similar to Austria during the Cold War period. The ex-state senator, Richard Black, emphasized that Russia's security concerns were justifiable and without a doubt needed to be taken into consideration by neighboring countries.
Comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.